on ABC Radio.
This is The Big Fish
with Scott Levi.
Ahoy there, welcome aboard another episode of The Big Fish. Do you love fresh local Sydney rock oysters? They're one of the most polarising of foods, I think. You either think they're God's greatest culinary gift to the world or the worst thing in the world you could possibly put in your mouth. I'm in the first category, I just love them. But they're in big trouble with Sydney rock oyster disease QX getting into the state's biggest oyster growing region, Port Stephens. According to the New South Wales government, the oyster industry in New South Wales is worth around $60 million. It makes all other aquaculture pale into insignificance. Up next, we'll catch up with oyster grower who believes that if we don't save the oysters, we won't save our rivers. They're integral to a healthy system and all of those fish we love to catch.
Perplexed about the latest picture show, but there is really only just one thing I'd like to know. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? No matter what I do, the answer won't come through. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? That's a question I would like an answer to.
Peter O'Sullivan from the Oyster Shed on the Hawkesbury River. The Agriculture Minister is visiting your patch on Monday, the central coast of New South Wales. What could he do to save an industry that's really on its knees?
Well, there's not a lot. Stop the rain would be a good idea, a bit of a start. The rain hasn't been, we haven't had a year like this ever. You know, we and poor old Port Stephens just copped the QX disease, which we've had, we had 12 years ago here. The QX is a horrible parasite. It's a microscopic parasite that actually attacks the gut of the oyster. It's not harmful to humans, but it's harmful to the industry. It's we have got there is breeding programs to through natural selection of oysters that lived through the parasite attacks. And that's where we're working with in Hawkesbury River to try and lessen our problems. But we've got the Warragamba Dam. Every time the oyster, the river comes salty enough to sell oysters out of, they dump more water out of the dam and bring the salinity down again. So that, it's been 8 months since we've been able to sell one of our own oysters. There's a lot of different things we can do, but none of them are going to be easy, I don't think.
What about attrition with the low salinity? It can kill them as well. You'd already lost a lot of stock because of that. What about the latest releases and freshers in the river? What impact have they had?
Well, even the oysters on the rocks are dying. And they never even died that through all of all the other problems they've had. They've never had all the local and the wild stuff dying. So it's actually affecting the whole ecosystem.
Just so much fresh.
With so much fresh, yes.
For so long.
For so long. We've never had we've had floods before that have been just as probably as bad as the last couple, but not as a longer period of time. They kept the fresh water down so long, which changes the whole structure of the river.
What could happen to the Port Stephens Karua area? It is one of the world's largest growing oyster areas. They've been taking a lot of the slack while other areas have been affected by low salinity and flooding. If the QX gets hold there, what could happen? I mean, what happened 12 years ago to the oyster farmers on the Hawkesbury?
Well, there was at least 30 oyster farmers on the Hawkesbury River. I think there's four now left, probably the most stubborn ones, and it could happen the same thing as the Port Stephens. Because oysters are very, very important to the whole river system. One oyster filters 180 litres of water a day. So they're really good for the environment. And all the calcium and the carbon that we lock up in all the shell is a wonderful thing as well. Mm. Without oysters, you don't have fish, so it wrecks the fisheries. It's something that with New York, they put 1 billion oysters in their river to try and clean their river. They realise what an important part of the ecosystem that is.
What about the QX itself, trying to breed spat that's resistant? Do we have enough of that stock to help the farmers out?
Nowhere near enough stock, and we've had a lot of failures last year. They just couldn't work it out. They were trying to breed to help all the farmers, but they were all fighting to get stock, and the hatcheries are going down too. I think we've got to support the hatcheries so that we can get stock to keep the whole industry going.
Is any assistance coming? We hear so much about assistance for all the other types of farmers. Has anything come your way? These are exceptional circumstances, and disease on top of that for those poor farmers at Port Stephens. I mean, is there any package available to keep them going?
I think there is, but there's still bureaucratic hurdles to go past. We did get a grant for the 2001 flood, and that really helped us out. But this one, we haven't received anything yet, but we're still working on it.
And when you talk aquaculture in New South Wales, I know there are other emerging industries and a lot of experimental stuff, but the tried and true one, the backbone of it, that generates tens of millions of dollars, really is the oyster industry, and our best oyster of the Sydney Rock, isn't it? The QX, of course, gets that. The POMS is a disease that goes to the Pacifics, which are a bit controversial in some of the waterways. A lot of people prefer the native oyster. But what impact is POMS having? Is it something to worry about as well?
Most definitely. POMS is a viral disease which attacks the Pacific oyster only. When the Hawkesbury River got QX, we went to the Pacifics to fill the void. And the problem with that, then we went very well. We grew beautiful oyssters. And then the POMS hit us and wiped us out on that as well. So we went back to the drawing board again, twice. Non-harmful to humans again, but it's deadly on oysters. I lost 1.2 million oysters in a day, which is pretty hard to take.
Just awful. So many hours, so many years growing them. It's just so, you work so hard. It's just, and all of your staff, it's just awful, awful, Pete. This QX, getting back to the QX, it's a bit of a mystery, is it? It came out of Queensland, didn't it? That's why it's called QX, Queensland's sort of unknown disease.
Yes, yes.
What's its story? Do you know much about it?
I only know that it's a microscopic single cell parasite that attacks the feeding system of the Sydney Rock. They have got another oyster in that is very. It is a Sydney Rock. It's the same genus, but it actually doesn't. It's very very resistant to it. So we're trying to work on that, but it takes time, and something that we haven't got a lot of.
And we need more research. I was just reading on the Queensland Museum site that it affects oysters. The parasite has a life cycle which is thought to involve two hosts, the oysters and a marine worm, but the complete life cycle has yet to be confirmed by scientists. So they still don't know about this oyster wasting and killing disease enough about it, do they?
That's correct. So what we're trying to do is find oysters that seem to be we put them with the disease, but we reinfect them, and the ones that we live, then we keep on reinfecting until we get an oyster that's tough enough to handle it. You know, they've nearly got that, but nothing's ever a complete science. We need some support to hatcheries and people to look into it a bit more. And when every time you look at an ad for tourism in Australia, it's always got oysters on it. It's no use people coming to Australia if they and they want to have oysters and you can't get them. And if we don't do some research on it or spend money on research, well, that's what's going to happen.
And the worth to New South Wales, estimates of around $60 million. It is really the pinnacle of aquaculture. I mean, that's a lot of money in little coastal towns and rivers and estuaries up and down the coast, isn't it?
Most definitely, and that's what happened here in the Horsley, where when the oysters went, a lot of other industries went with it. Like there's a lot of people that rely on it. It's a knock-on effect, and it could really make things hard for everybody and everywhere, and especially Port Stephens. I'm very worried about those guys.
You just hope and pray that it doesn't get going there, because everyone saw it. If you took a train from the north into Sydney, that followed the most beautiful train ride in the world, I think, follows the river, and to see all those racks that used to be full of oysters and just dead sticks and nothing on them when that QX came through, it was sad to see, wasn't it?
Most definitely. That's why I started oyster farming myself. I've always had a love for oyster farming, and I thought, well, put my money where my mouth is and try and have a go. But it has been a very difficult time. I was just on the phone to the Cole boys a minute ago, just before you, would you believe? And they're doing their best, and I think they'll get through it, but it's not going to be an easy time. And they've already been through it here as well, so it's a bit of a bugger.
How much of your stock do you still have? Do you know how many are left and what you had before the floods?
Well, I've lost every Pacific I had. They can't handle any fresh water at all. Sydney Rock is a fairly strong oyster. It can handle a lot of fresh. It can handle a lot of hot weather because it's basically used to our local area. You know, but I think I've lost about 50% of that as well, which when people realise, they say, oh, the oyster is expensive, but they take 3 years to grow. And then if you lose them, then you've got to put another oyster in and take another 3 years to grow it. So you've got 6 years out before you make any money, and which makes it very difficult.
And, Peter, I'm trying to think positive here, because Sydney Rock oysters are the most favourite food in the world. I think Simon Marnie, who follows on from me on the Saturday morning show, is in the same boat. He's a great supporter of the industry too, and tries to keep the growers going by eating as much as he possibly can. Wouldn't the fact that you haven't been able to harvest, that the rules are so strict around the water quality, even though the water quality is fine, but there's too much fresh coming down.
That's right, yes.
Surely, eventually, those oysters that you haven't been able to take off the leases might be really fat, really big.
Well, they are. It's actually a crying shame to be buying oysters in and having your own that are twice as big.
Yeah, or when you can harvest, give me a hoy, would you? I'll bring some money and come and buy a few dozen, because they will be big and fat and juicy once you can get back into it when the fresh goes out of the river.
Thank you very much.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
Are worried over how they'll pay the rent, and some folks are annoyed because they can't lay up a cent. Others are perplexed about the latest picture show, but there is really only just one thing I'd like to know. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? No matter what I do, the answer won't come through. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? That's a question I would like an answer to. A little piece of cheese annoys a mouse, there is no doubt. But here's the one thing I've been trying hard to figure out. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster when an oyster's in a stew? What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? I asked them at the zoo. They said they wished they knew. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? That's a question I would like an answer to. A piece of cheese annoys the mouse annoys in turn. The cat who then annoys the dog, but still I cannot learn. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster when an oyster's in a stew? Oysters live a life within a very narrow scope. One thing I've found out is that an oyster don't like soap. I'll admit the problem's been a sticker from the go. I've asked most everyone I've met and no one seems to know. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? I figured till I'm blue, so now I'm asking you. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? That's a question I would like an answer to. A piece of cheese annoys the mouse annoys the cat annoys the dog annoys your Sunday hat. But what kind of a noise annoys an oyster when an oyster's in a stew? What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? I've asked each one I knew from here to Kalamazoo. What kind of a noise annoys an oyster? That's a question I would like an answer to. Now simple things annoy a lot of simple folks, you see. And that's most likely why this question is annoying me. But what kind of a noise annoys an oyster when an oyster's in a stew?
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
The Boozers Creek Outback Fishermen's Club hadn't seen rain in years, so they boarded a bus without any fuss. Their eskies held 10,000 beers. Bound for the coast were a good dozen starters to fish the deep sea with Dodgy Dick's charters. They arrived at the port already half dusted. Most wouldn't have caught the skin off a custard. Out through the heads and all went well until they encountered a 6-metre swell. Still they ploughed through the lager without any fear, but the catch of the day would be Maldemere. It was Charles Chuck Berry first to provide a trail of fresh burley heaved over the side. It brought on the snapper, which came out of the reef. Then Chuck hurled so hard he spat out his false teeth. Through the depths sinking, his fangs spiraled down, while the green-gilled old bushy watched on with a frown. Said club captain Mick, with a wink to his mates, "Watch this for a laugh, it's gonna be great." He whipped out his falsies, pearly white and fine, and when Chuck's back was turned, tied them onto his line. Mick lifted his rig, a paternoster, two droppers, and said with surprise, "Chuck, I've just caught your choppers." Old Chuck snatched them quickly, right out of Mick's grasp, and between his bare gums, the teeth he did clasp. With a garbled sea curse and an almighty spit, he cried, "Those aren't my dentures, they do bloody fit." But before Mick could count from 1 to 3, Chuck hurled the false teeth back into the sea. The Boozers Creek boys were now splitting their sides. All the while, the fetching swell rose with the tide. Oblivious to all, Chuck re-emptied his tummy, while Mick looked on crestfallen, forlorn, po-faced and gummy.
on ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
Chasing those Yukon Bean spawn runners, you might need some thermals under your waders if you're wading in the waters. It's pretty icy down in the snowies, but lots of good fishing. Stinker's a bit of a primitive, and he reckons you don't need a lot of gear to catch a lot of fish. Talking about primitive methods with Stinker, next on The Big Fish.
On ABC Radio, it's The Big Fish with Scott Levi.
Here comes Stinker with his fishing tips. Some hot advice for your fishing trip. Where to find him? What's the bait?
Are you catching any, mate?
Morning, Stinker.
Hey, g'day, Scott.
Hey, for a lot of new people to fishing, it's a bit too complicated, isn't it? Talk us through primitive methods. I mean, what I remember, we never had swivels. We always used a half a matchstick. Dad was a smoker, so you always had a box of matches, and you half hitched half a matchstick on to stop your sinker from going down to the hook, or no sinker at all. It was the best way to go, but you know, we never had swivels and all these newfangled modern things. What are primitive methods? You were talking about catching those Leno mullet the other day. How did you do that?
Oh, gee, well, you're talking to the right person to talk about primitive methods, because I still use primitive methods. I'm primitive. I'm a prehistoric fisher person and loving it. You know, because I'm always of the belief that if it works, keep doing it. That's my theory on fishing. And some of my methods are so old, because my father was a rod maker, and I've mentioned on this program that he used to, we'd lop Rangoon cane that would come from overseas and have big knobs and leaves. If they had leaves off it, and then you had to try and find one that was straight, and then you'd get a heavy rasp and you'd rasp all the knobs off it, and then you'd get varnish and miller's thread, and oh, look, it was really primitive stuff. But it worked, Scott. It worked. And people would buy those rods like nothing on earth, you know, porcelain runners. Remember those old runners? If you dropped them on the rock, all the runners would smash.
They were made of porcelain, yeah, like the insulators on top of the old telegraph wires, yeah.
Well, even cups. There were porcelain cups.
That's right,
too.
Yeah. It was very, very good, though. It was very fragile, but it was very, very slick. You know, you got no resistance when you were casting.
Oh, well, that's all right. But if, like I said, if you drop it on the ground, all your runners would smash. Well, that wasn't...
But, you know, we're moving back to more sustainable methods. I mean, cane grows like a weed. You know, there's no environmental damage in making a cane rod these days, is there?
Well, it's not the same cane. You might see bamboo growing on the side of the road or even in some people's backyard. It's not bamboo. It's a different stuff. It's a Rangoon cane. And then there used to be the old split cane. Do you ever seen a split cane, Rod?
That's right. Yes, they're still really revered and prized by the fly fishers, because they shave thin pieces of bamboo and then stick it together in a sort of a hexagonal shape, whereas the Rangoon was just one piece of the cane, wasn't it?
Well, I'm not too sure where it all come from. I knew Rangoon, it was over in Burma. I assumed that's where it come from. And we used to pick it up on the wharves in Brisbane, on the Brisbane River. But I never really asked where it come from. But when it turned up, it just looked a big bush, because there were all these leaves and everything. We say, how are we going to make a fishing rod out of this?
What do you do? You'd assume but it came from Rangoon.
As you say, going fishing wasn't really complicated. You give an old Coca-Cola bottle, and you might have 20 metres or 30 metres of line on it, and then you'd have your hook, and they're all what they call French Kirby hooks. They're all brown, old brown hooks that used to rust like crazy, but they worked. And then you'd have a bolt, either a bolt or a spark plug for a sinker. And if you wanted it to slide up and down, you'd tie a matchstick on it, and then you'd put your yabby. You'd have yabby pumps. You ever have seen one of those original yabby pump? Oh, they were sensational things. Big cylinders, galvanized tin cylinders, and then you'd push them down into the sand, and then you'd block off the air, and then you'd pull, and this big lump of sand would come out of the ground, and then you'd jump down, you'd lay on the ground, and put your hand straight down the hole. And that was my job. My uncles would dig the hole, and I'd have to go down the hole.
They can bite.
I was serving my apprenticeship. And then you'd throw all the yabbies up onto the ground. But then one bloke was silly enough to tell me that he did that once and pulled out a snake. Well, I wasn't real happy after that. I sort of wasn't.
I tell you what, and they do give you a nip, as they're called nippers for a reason. That would make you a little bit toey. We're speaking to Stinker about primitive methods. You know, the old Rangoon cane rod, the carved wooden, the rosewood, those red, beautiful wooden alveys. They were the beach and rock gear of the day, weren't they? They were prized, and still plenty of them about. I mean, they never broke the old reels, did they?
Well, see, they're a collector's item now. The old rosewood alvey, beautiful, beautiful reel. Something to treasure, really. But I think what remains indelible in my mind was the day that I was fishing on King Tommy. That's the rock that I have to swim to. And I'm fishing there, and I'm throwing sort of 60 metres out to sea onto a reef, and I'm using a quarter-pound lead, and what did I have, 25-pound line and a 6-0 hook. And, oh, dear, it was rather a complicated issue. But it was very early in the morning, and there was hardly any colour in the sky, and I heard this noise behind me, which is quite extraordinary because I'm the only one on this rock out in the middle of the ocean. And to hear this sort of scratching, scraping noise behind me, I thought, what on earth is that? I turned around, and here's an elderly man. He wasn't, I don't know how old he was, but he'd probably been in his late 60s, I suppose. I don't know. I never asked him how old he was. But he wasn't a young man. That's the easiest way to say it. And he's crawled up out of the water, and he's got a bag, a Hessian bag. And I'm said, mate, what are you doing out here in this rock in the middle of the ocean with a Hessian bag? And he said, oh, look, I've come out to catch a snapper. I said, oh, okay. I said, well, this is a good spot. This is where they are. And he said, do you mind moving? You're standing on where I want to fish. I said, oh, okay. It's a big rock. But the reason was because where I was standing was flat. It was flat like a tabletop. So what he did, he took his one of those big hand lines. You know those big wooden rings?
Yeah, great big ring, yep, with a lip on it, yep.
Yeah, that's it. And they were beautiful too. And they're also a collector's item. Well, he took out this big wooden ring, and then he peeled off maybe, 60 or 70 metres of line, and then he had the quarter-pound lead and the 6-0 hook, and he had two whiting in his bag. And I said, what's happening here, mate? What are you doing? He said, well, this... And he filleted the two whiting, so he had four fillets of fish, and he put the whiting on the hook, and then he said, stand back, mate. And I said, rightio. So I moved out of his range, and he started swinging this around like a helicopter. And you know, the woo, 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 and woo, and I'm holy smokes. And then he let it go, and it flew way out to sea, like as far, further than I could throw with my fishing rod. He threw this hand line, and then he stood there on the lip of the rock. So he was looking straight down, probably 10 foot down into the water. And then his line straightened like a violin string, and he said, here we go. And he started pulling. He pulled in, the snapper was about three kilo, and he put on another whiting fillet, and he caught another one about the same size, and he said, that'll do for today. He wound everything out, put the fish and the line back in the bag, left the other two fillets of whiting on the rock, and I never ever saw him again. He jumped back in the sea. And I never ever saw him again. And I'm sitting there, I scratch my head, and I still do. I said, because he's done it before, obviously.
Oh, obviously, yeah. Before. Just amazing. Well, you know, my dear old grandmother, who caught as many fish off the beach as anyone and loved beach fishing, she had dodgy knees from playing too much tennis, she would use a hand line off the beach and throw it a mile just like that, and she'd pull in flathead and brim and tail or anything that was on the go. And I'm thinking about the old retro Coke bottle as a hand line, because it was perfect. You know, got the waist of it where the line, you'd put the line on, and then it was glass, so the line would just slide off. You'd swing it around your head and let it rip, and away it'd go. And it reminds me of the time my brother and I got a little rubber boat, you know, when they were a prized possession. We got a tiny little rubber boat, and we're in Lake Macquarie. We would have been about 10 or 11, I guess. He's a few years older, and we're rowing this thing around, and I see this Coke bottle spinning in the water. And I said, because there's a lot of wharves around there then. A lot of them are gone now. I said, someone set that line, and it's taken off with a Dewey or something on it. So he rowed over. I'm in this tiny little rubber boat, and I've grabbed the bottle, and I never forget, I felt the big weight of this, whatever it was, on the end of the line, and then zhooshed, the last couple of feet of line just went off the end of the bottle. And I was left with just a bottle in my hand and still wondering, Stinker, what the monster on the other end was.
Well, those pump-up boats, they have a couple of negatives too. I mean, I used to swim, as I said, over onto this rock. And after a while, I thought, this is no good. Plus, I'm no good at swimming. I'll get a little plastic pump-up boat. And it had Mickey Mouse on it. You know, you get them from Woolies, they cost you about $8 or something like that. Yeah. Anyway, and it was orange. I remember it was orange. And it had two little oars, and I thought, well, this will do. So I actually pumped it up, and I took it over there. I put it in the water, and I jumped in it with all my gear, and I started paddling over onto this rock. But then when the big wave receded, I ended up on a bed of kanji voi, and the dreaded sound went, and down I went.
Barnacles.
There I was, floundering around with this flat thing with a big hole in it, and so I went back to swimming. I tried a surfboard too for a while, but now I go in stink pot, and I don't even get wet now.
You didn't tell me, when you took me there, you didn't really tell me much about the swimming. There's still a little bit of swimming when we went out to the outer rock, and we parked the boat in a little tiny crack where it just fits so it doesn't get smashed onto the rocks by the sea. And then we walked over one rock, and then next minute, Stinker's just straight in. I said, come on, you want to go fishing or standing around? I said, all right. So in I went. Away we went. It was a wild trip.
Well, you got to time that right too, because in that gap that we jump into, in the sea, in a big sea, that'll wash through there. And if you jump in at the wrong time, you'll end up 20 metres from where you want to be. And so you've got to wait for the wave to wash out. And just before it starts to wash in again, that's when you've got to jump and go for it. Otherwise, you'd go 20 metres in the wrong direction.
I'm glad you had to swim across that gulch with the bag of with a pack full of fish. We had some beautiful drummer and snapper and everything, brim. And I said, mate, if I try to swim across with that, I'll go to the bottom. It was so heavy. It was a great, great day, but only when it's right too, you know. And I think that's why the fishing's so good, because you couldn't go there every day. You know, everything's got to line up, hasn't it?
Oh, look, that's true with fishing as a whole. You've got to wait for that window of opportunity, and it hasn't been there very often lately because the weather's been dreadful, absolutely dreadful and unpredictable and certainly not conducive to having a good time fishing. It's just dreadful.
Yeah, anyway, I think our listeners who want to get into fishing, just a line, a hook and a bit of bait, that's enough. Don't overcomplicate it. As you say, it's not hard catching them, it's hard finding them.
That's the trick in fishing, is finding where they live.
Yeah, good stuff, Stinker. Thanks for taking us through some of the primitive methods, and they still work. Tight lines, mate.
Hello, Scott.
The Big Fish with Scott Levi on ABC Radio.
That's a great thing about this recreational pastime that we love. It can be as simple or as complex as you want it to be. It's a wonderful, absorbing adventure. We're going saltwater fly fishing next.
Well, now take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. We may not get a bite all day, but don't you rush away. What a great place to rest your bones, and mighty fine for skipping stones. You'll feel fresh as a lemonade setting in the shade. Whether it's hot, whether it's cool, oh, what a spot for whistling like a fool. What a fine day to take a stroll and wander by the fishing hole. I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day. We'll have no need to call the road when we get to the fishing hole. There'll be you, me, and old dog Trey to doodle time away. If we don't hook a perch or bass, we'll cool our toes in dewy grass, or else pull up a weed to chaw and maybe set and jaw. Hanging around, taking our ease, watching that hound, a scratching at his fleet. Come on, take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. I can't think of a better way to pass the time of day.
It's The Big Fish with Scott Levi, and isn't it great that we still make stuff in this country? Handmade stuff is beautiful, isn't it? Brett Clark and Cherie Forbes have bucked the trend and opened a saltwater fly fishing shop. Brett's on the line. Good morning, Brett.
G'day, Scott. How are you today?
Yes, it's really good that we've got manufacturing and an outlet. You must tie flies all night and then man the shop all day.
Yeah, something like that. It's a bit of a juggling act these days, to be honest. So, yeah, I still tie a few flies, and yeah, we've got the retail shop open now. So, yeah, it's been quite a journey.
I was talking to one of the fellas in the Fly Rodders Club, and he said, you know, people overcomplicate saltwater fly fishing. You just get an olive crazy Charlie and strip it over or just near the weed beds, and you'll catch a brim for sure. It's amazing, isn't it? We go way up into the mountains to chase trout and all the rest of it when there are all these great fly fishing options right at our backyard. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that is fair to say. Like, Central Coast particularly has a great diverse range of fly targets. You know, we've got a great, you know, saltwater fishery with the lakes and the creeks around here. And then, you know, if you do want to travel into the fresh, then, you know, you've got the bass in the fresh reaches. Or if you want to travel a little bit further, you've got good access to the trout waters as well. So, it's quite a good area to be based in.
Going off at the moment too, the freshwater scene is just on fire because of the fresh water, because of the amount of water. But if you're on an estuary from the Tweed to Bega or to Mallacoota over the Victorian border, it's all pretty similar, isn't it? You know, chasing brim, chasing whiting, chasing flathead. What are some of the flies and some of the techniques that people can use to get into this? So you need a six weight to do your fine, wouldn't it?
Oh, definitely a six weight, you know, would be the perfect place to start for the estuary work, and particularly for those species that you mentioned. You know, the whiting, the brim and the flathead, they're all very achievable targets with a fly rod. A six weight is perfect for all of those species. And you mentioned one of the common fly patterns before being the Charlie or the Crazy Charlie. You know, that's a very successful fly, you know, particularly on the brim. Some slightly larger ones for the flathead. Clouser minnow is perfect fly for the flathead, as it's usually weighted with lead dumbbell eyes, and it can get to the bottom where those flathead live. And then the whiting, you know, once the prawns start running and the estuaries, you know, become, you know, alive with activity, then, you know, they're a great challenge, you know, on the fly rod. And you can use little Crazy Charlies again, you know, possibly in sizes 10 and 8, possibly a 6. But then you can present some small poppers to them, you know, with a floating line. And they're a dynamic fish, you know, when you're fishing them on top water. So that can be a real blast.
That's a real natural presentation too, is a little popping shrimp fly. I know Peter Morse developed a very simple one to tie, and you guys would probably have that one. And it's actually mimicking what the prawns do. When the whiting try to suck them in and disturb them out of the sand in the bottom of our sandy estuaries, they go straight to the top, don't they, and jump and try to get away. And that's when the whiting chase them. And it's so exciting. It's really, I this is my theory, replicating that natural behaviour of the shrimp or the prawn.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's it. That's exactly what happens, is that that prawn or that shrimp tries to flee, you know, from being eaten. And it creates a bit of a commotion on the surface. And, you know, and then, you know, the fish gets, I suppose, agitated or hungrier or, you know, or motivated to, you know, to try and chase that down and eat it, you know. So you really want your fly to represent what's happening, you know, at the time. So, but particularly when those, you know, when those prawn runs are happening and, the prawns are, you know, I suppose, towards the surface of the water column, it's a great way to fish if you can fish it, you know, in a top water presentation. There's really nothing better.
We're speaking with Brett Clark, and along with his partner, Sheree Forbes, they tie saltwater flies. It's quite a niche industry, but they're making a good go of it, all Australian manufacturing. And it's wonderfully innovative too. I mean, the things you do are just fantastic. And that whiting fishing is really exciting. You can do that out of a kayak. You can do a bit of fly hacking or and any of those little lagoons, sandy bottom estuaries up and down the coast. You'd be surprised at how many prawns are living just under the sand there with their eyes just poking out. You see it when they're running, don't you? They come out in droves.
Oh, you certainly do, you know. And then, you know, once that bait fish activity or that prawn activity starts to happen, you know, more so in the springs, you know, spring and summer months, I suppose, then yeah, all of those species become more active in the water, and they're feeding up, and you know, they all become very viable, you know, very viable fly targets, you know. And I find fly fishing very, you know, it's got a challenging element to it, but it's also very, very rewarding to catch, you know, to catch a fish on fly. You know, you get a real buzz, you know, from customers that have caught their first one in the shop, you know, and then that motivates them just to keep going and, you know, becoming better at it or refining their skills, and then, you know, being motivated to target new species and open up new challenges to their own angling. So it's pretty much anything in the water these days that you know, that eats, you can target it with a fly. There's you know, there's something out there, or there's a, you know, there's an outfit out there that would, you know, would help you achieve, you know, what your goals are. So it's quite good.
Leno Mullet on bread flies, you know, Drummer and Luderick on weed flies and bread flies, and these are all sorts of fish that people would never think you could target on the fly rod, and they're really great fish to target on the fly rod. I think the great thing about what you do too is you do design beautiful flies and give people a bit of an idea about the proportions and the weight and all those important things, because they've not only got to look good and work well in the water and look lifelike, and all those soft materials do come to life in the water, but they've also got to be aerodynamic. They've got to be castable. They really won't work. So design is everything, but people can get materials from you as well and make their own. It's really a great craft as well as a great outdoor sport.
Yeah, 100%. There's a gazillion materials available, you know, from the traditional naturals, you know, the bucktails and the deer hairs and the foxes and that kind of thing, squirrel tails, and right through to, you know, to man-made, you know, synthetic materials, and then to components, you know, which just help you know, build a better fly, help people, you know, to achieve what they're looking for in terms of their fly tying. So yeah, there certainly is an enormous range of fly tying equipment, you know, for people to be able to use their imaginations. You know, they can stick to the tried and trusted patterns. They might tweak it a little bit, you know, change some color threads, put some hot spots on it, or they can go, you know, they can get really imaginative and, you know, put propellers on the, you know, on the front of their flies or the back of their flies. And, you know, really, it's endless these days. It really is.
Yeah, it's great fun, and it's a really great hobby, getting into fly tying. And now that we're really getting into saltwater fly fishing for our bread and butter species, I think there'll be a lot of people out there that's their only vice, perhaps, is tying flies.
Yeah.
And it's a great time on the cold winter's nights to sit by the fire and tie a few flies, but just not for trout. I think that's really important. There's so much fun to be had in our estuaries. Tight lines and tight loops. Brett Clark, thanks for joining us on The Big Fish.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.